do. What we cannot do is stand around dithering while our capital is under attack. What, we're going to leave it up to Mandrake? How good a magician do you think he is? I'm going for my wolves. Anyone with any remaining ambition will follow me." She pushed herself back from the doorframe, and without a backward glance set off down the corridor. Uneasy silence. After a pause, three of the young men, heads lowered, brows scowling, pushed their way past Kitty and departed. Several others wavered, but remained. The young woman with mousy hair shrugged. She turned to Kitty.
"We're following you, Miss—" "Sorry, what is your name?" "Clara Bell? Lizzie Temple?"
"Kitty Jones," she said. Then, more faintly, "Can anyone get me something to drink?"
While Kitty rested, while she sipped cool mineral water from the council's own supply of bottles, the junior magicians set about their work. Some ventured around the Whitehall chambers. They returned, trembling and wan, with reports of bodies piled inside rooms, of pentacles slashed and ruptured, of such devastation as none had ever dreamed. Carnage like this was generally visited on enemies at a distance. It was troubling for the magicians to experience it firsthand. Others crept to the front of the building and peered forth into Whitehall. Buildings were on fire. Corpses lay in full view. What was most unsettling was the utter absence of the people. Ordinarily, even in the small hours, buses and taxis continued to pass that way, together with the comings and goings of night staff in the ministries and patrols of police and soldiers. The machinery of government, beheaded by the treachery of Makepeace and surprised by the appearance of Nauda, had for the moment ceased altogether. The destruction of the pentacles was a setback, but it soon became clear that the ferocity of the demons exceeded their efficiency, and here and there circles were found that had been overlooked and spared. A few small imps set forth on reconnaissance. Meanwhile, in a chamber close to the Hall of Statues, a giant crystal ball, formerly employed by the council, was located and brought to the room where Kitty sat. The magicians congregated, hushed and sombre. Without preamble, the strongest individual present, a junior minister from the fisheries, summoned the jinni trapped within the ball. In ringing tones it was directed to its task, to reveal the position of the renegade demons. The ball went smoky, dark. Everyone leaned closer. Lights within the crystal. Red and orange, leaping flames. The focus cleared. Raging fires near and far. Lanterns among dark trees. In the distance a giant hump-backed glow of light.
"The Glass Palace," someone said. "That's St. James's Park."
The commoners were demonstrating there.
"Look!"
In the foreground, hundreds of running forms, wheeling, scattering like fish shoals through the trees.
"Why don't they get out?"
"Surrounded!"
Here and there, bursts of magic, corralling the panic-stricken crowds, redirecting them back upon themselves. Glimpses of unnatural movement on the margins, great bounds and leaps, sudden rushes. Hopping, prancing figures, human in their shape, inhuman in their gleeful capering, active on all sides. One loped into clear view beneath a lantern. It spied a cluster of men and women fleeing in its direction. It bent its back, prepared to spring. A shaft of white light, a tremendous explosion. The loping creature vanished, in its place a smoking crater. A figure passed beneath the lantern out of sight, going with steady strides. It held a long staff in its hand. Kitty placed her mineral water carefully on the floor.
"Summon whatever demons you can," she said. "If we're going to do any good at all, that's where we have to be."
Chapter 35. Bartimaeus. It has to be said, we worked well together. Better than either of us expected. Okay, maybe it took a little while to get the system sorted. We had a couple of embarrassing moments when our body did two things at once. But we always rectified it sharpish, so no harm done. Well, not to me, anyway, safely encased as I was inside. Nathaniel maybe got a few unnecessary bruises, like the time he went right when I was pointing left, and the staff bashed him on the nose. or when he fired the staff during the middle of an extra fancy leap and we were blown sideways into a gorse bush, or that little incident down at the lake when he got so angry. We were only underwater for a measly 4 or 5 seconds, and let's face it, a little bindweed never hurt anyone. But by and large, we managed to avoid self-inflicted wounds. And once we got into our 7-league stride, we really began to motor, and to enjoy the advantages of our irregular condition. It was our first success against poor old Narian that really fired us up. It showed us what we had to do, how to combine to best effect. We stopped trying to second-guess each other, and did a bit of delegation. Here's how it went. Nathaniel worked the boots. If we had a long, straight distance to travel, he did the strides. Once at our destination, 1 or 2 seconds later, generally, those boots were pretty snappy, I took over the legs, imbued them with a little of my trademarked vim, and sent us bounding like an impala, back, forth, up, down, left and right, until any enemy, and occasionally even myself, was hopelessly confused. Meanwhile, Nathaniel retained full control of his arms and of Gladstone's staff. He fired it whenever we came within range, and since I could anticipate his intentions, I usually stayed put long enough for him to do so. The only exception, justified I feel, was when I was hurrying us out of the path of a detonation, a flux, or a spiralling dismemberment. Always best to avoid such things, if you wish to retain momentum. Or indeed your vital organs. We communicated with pithy, rather monosyllabic thoughts, viz. Run, jump, where, left, up, duck, etc. This latter was an observation I made on the edge of the lake. Nathaniel, unfortunately, took it as a command, which resulted in our temporary immersion. We didn't ever quite say ugh, but it was a close-run thing. It was all a bit butch and male, and left little room for introspection or emotional analysis, a factor that fitted in nicely with the business of staying alive, and also with a certain subdued detachment that now flooded Nathaniel's mind. It hadn't been so noticeable at first, when we were back with Kitty. His head was full of softer things then, half-formed, eager, outward-looking. But after that moment in Trafalgar Square, when the woman had turned away from him with a face of fear and scorn, it rose up swiftly and closed him off. His softer emotions were new and hesitant. They didn't like rejection. Now they were sealed away. In their stead returned the old familiar qualities, pride, remoteness, and steely determination. He was still committed to his task, but he undertook it in an attitude of vague self-disgust. Not healthy, maybe, but it helped him fight well. And fighting, now, was what we had to do. Narian, dawdling at the square, had been the most tardy of the spirits. The others had hurried on, drawn by the sound and smell of human bodies, under the Churchill Arch and out into the dark acres of St. James's Park. Perhaps if the commoners had not been congregated here in considerable numbers, Nauda's army would have immediately dispersed across the capital, and so been far harder to discover and waylay. As it was, the people's protest had been gathering through the night, emboldened by the government's inertia. Now, for the avid spirits, their teeming masses provided an unmissable temptation. When we arrived, the entertainment was well underway. Far across the park, the spirits wandered, chasing herds of fleeing humans as the whim took them. Some used magical attacks, others preferred to move for the sake of moving, trying out the unfamiliar stiffness of their limbs, racing around to cut off scurrying prey. Many of the distant trees were aflame with coloured lights. The air was a montage of flashes, spinning cords of smoke, shrill screams, and general outcry. Behind it all, the great glass palace cast illumination down upon the hectic lawns. Across its projected slabs of light, the people ran, the spirits bounded, the bodies fell, the breathless hunt went on. We paused under the arch, at the gateway to the park, taking it all in. Chaos, Nathaniel thought. It's chaos. It's nothing to a real battle, I said. You ought to have been at Al-Arish, where for 2 square miles the sand clogged red. I gave him a mental picture. Lovely. Thanks for that. See Nauda? No. How many demons are there?
Enough. Let's go.
There were probably 40 or so, but when entering battle, a wise warrior deals with his enemies one by one. He tapped his heel. The boots took wing. We launched ourselves into the fray. Strategy dictated that the spirits did not collectively notice our presence. One by one, we could fell them. Facing them en masse would be a mite more tricky. Hence, rapid-fire attacks and continual movement. Our first objective, close by on the lawns, was an afreet cloaked in the body of an elderly woman, uttering shrill whoops. It sent spasms ricocheting among the crowds. In two strides, we were behind it. The staff pulsed. The afreet was a memory, sighing on the wind. We turned, moved, and were far off among the fairground stalls, where three strong djinn, plumply dressed in human skin, industriously toppled the Sultan's castle. Nathaniel pointed the staff and claimed them in a single greedy flash of light. We looked, saw. Up by some trees, a rickety hybrid stalking a child. In three strides we had him in our sights. White fire consumed him. The child fled into the dark. We need help, Nathaniel thought, for the people. They're running round in circles.
That's not Arkan.
Yep, I see them. Go. A stride, a leap. We landed on a bandstand roof, spun round the central pole, fired the staff four times. Three hybrids perished. The fourth, alerted by the others' deaths, dodged, jumped back. It spied us, sent a spasm. The bandstand shook itself to splinters, but we had somersaulted clear, slid down a tent awning, and before our boots touched ground, reduced the culprit's essence to a twirl of dwindling sparks. A prickle of regret, a slackening of desire. Nathaniel hesitated.
That was Helen Malbindi. I know it was. She's
been dead long since. You killed her killer.
Shake a leg?
There, by the lake. Those children, quick, be swift. Best to keep moving. Best not to think of it. Fight on. Had the boy been there alone, without my prompting presence, would he have acted with such speed against the bodies of his fellow ministers? Despite their deformities, their slack faces and oddly angled limbs, I doubt it. He was a human. Always, always, humans gravitate to surfaces. 10 minutes passed. We stood beneath an oak tree in the centre of the park. The remains of two djinn rose smoking from the earth. Notice anything about the spirits, I thought. I mean, what you can see of them.
The eyes. I catch a glow sometimes.
Yes, but also the auras. They seem bigger, somehow.
Meaning what?
I don't know. It's like the human bodies aren't containing them so well.
You think?
The spirits Fakwal summoned are strong. Perhaps their feeding makes them stronger. If—
Wait! By the lake!
And we were gone. Back and forth across the park we went, among the pavilions and pleasure grounds, the bowers and the walkways, wherever we saw the flash of predatory movement. Sometimes the djinn perceived us and fought back. More often we slew them unawares. The power of the staff was irresistible. The 7-league boots carried us more swiftly than the enemy could see. Nathaniel was cold and resolute. With every minute he controlled the staff with greater skill. As for me, whether or not it was the adrenaline we shared, I began to enjoy myself hugely. I slowly awoke again to the old bloodlust, to the fierce joy of combat that I'd known in early Egypt's wars, when the Utuku of Assyria marched from the deserts and the gathering vultures blotted out the sky. It was the love of speed and cleverness, of defying death and dealing it. It was the love of carrying out new exploits that would be told and sung around the campfires till the sun went out. It was the love of energy and power. It was part of Earth's corruption. Ptolemy wouldn't have been pleased. But it was a good deal better than being a pyramid of slime. I noticed something and gave a mental prod. Nathaniel stopped where he was in the middle of the field to get a better look. We stood a while, considering. As we stood, we held the staff out horizontally, clasped in casual fingers. It glowed and crackled. White smoke drifted from the end. The ground beneath our boots was blackened, charred. All around us bodies lay, and shoes and coats and placards. Beyond them were burning trees and the deep abyss of night. Away across the park, the gleaming lights of the great glass palace. Within it, silhouetted upon the grass, distant figures seemed to move. We were too far away to make out any details. Nauda? Fakwal?
Could be.
Watch out!
Away to our left, something coming. We raised the staff. Paused. Out from the dark, a man came. Human, with negligible aura. He was shoeless, shirt half torn away. He stumbled past on bloodied feet. He never looked at us.
What a mess, Nathaniel thought.
Give the poor bloke a chance. He's just been chased by 40 demons.
Not him. This. Everything.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
So you reckon there were 40 total?
I didn't say that.
A wise warrior.
How many have we killed?
I don't know. Wasn't counting. There aren't so many here now, though.
The central vistas of the park were largely empty. It was as if an invisible skin or barrier had been punctured, and the mass of frantic movement had suddenly poured, then ebbed away. Nathaniel sniffed and wiped his nose upon a sleeve.
The glass palace it is, then. We're just about finished here.
One step, two. Up across the lawns and in among some ornamental hedges, flower beds, ponds, and tinkling fountains. Nathaniel slowed the boots. We took stock of our surroundings. The glass palace rose like a breaching whale from the centre of the park, 200 meters long and 100 wide. It was constructed almost entirely of glass panes, set among a web of iron girders. The main walls were gently soaring curves. Here and there protruded secondary domes, crests, minarets, and gables. It was nothing but a giant conservatory, really, but instead of containing a few mouldering tomato plants and a sack of compost, it boasted lines of full-grown palm trees, a man-made stream, aerial walkways, gift shops, and refreshment booths, as well as all manner of ramshackle entertainments. These included bumper cars, roller skating arenas, ride and imp merry-go-rounds, Madame Houri's mystic tent of prophecy, a hall of distorting mirrors, Bumpo the Bear's grotto of taxidermy, and the central One World exhibition, a series of pathetic stands displaying the cultural riches of each country of the empire, mainly involving squash, yams, and crudely painted wooden love spoons. The billboards outside proclaimed the palace as the 10th wonder of the world, which, speaking as someone who had a hand in constructing 5 of the other 9, I found a little rich. Thousands of electric lights hanging from the girders illuminated the area night and day. In ordinary times it was a favourite place for commoners to whittle away their lives. In the past I had rarely ventured near the palace, since its iron skeleton made my essence squeamish. Now, however, protected within Nathaniel, I had no such worries. We climbed some steps toward the eastern entrance. Here tropical ferns and palm trees pressed thickly against the inside of the glass. It was hard to see beyond them. Faint noises echoed from the building. We did not pause, but strode to the wooden doors. We pushed. The doors opened. Holding the staff before us, we stepped within. An instant mugginess. Out of the night's cold, under the roof of glass, the air was warm. An instant stench of magic, too. The after-plumes of sulphurous detonations. Somewhere to our right, beyond a knot of trees and a Japanese-style sushi bar, came sounds of lamentation.
Commoners, Nathaniel thought. Need to get close. See who's got them.
Try the walkway?
To our left, a spiral stair of iron led by rapid revolutions to a walkway high above. An elevated vantage point would give us immediate advantage. We crossed swiftly and scaled the steps without a sound. We rose above the spreading palm fronds, up tight against the curve of the great glass wall, and came out upon the narrow gantry, which extended like an iron thread to the opposite side. Nathaniel crouched low. He held the staff horizontal against the floor. With slow and careful movements, we shuffled out across the void. It did not take long before we could see beyond the trees to the centre of the palace, directly below the highest domes of soaring glass. Here, in an open space, wedged between the gaudily painted merry-go-round and an area of picnic tables, we saw a throng of humans, perhaps 100 strong, huddled together like penguins in a winter storm. They were marshalled by 7 or 8 of Nauda's spirits, who stood on every side. Rufus Lime's body was among their vehicles, as was, I knew this from an agitation within Nathaniel's mind, that of the Prime Minister, Rupert Devereux. From the authority of their movements, the spirits seemed comfortable in their hosts. Their auras had spread far around the outlines of the bodies. It was not they, however, who attracted our attention.
"Look at Nauda," Nathaniel thought. "What's happened to him?"
I had no answer. Up on the roof of the merry-go-round, perhaps 20 meters ahead and as many below us, the old body of Quentin Makepeace was standing. When we'd last set eyes on it, Nauda had been having a little trouble getting to grips with the limitations of his host. Now, belatedly, he seemed to have got the hang of it. The legs were firmly planted, the arms loosely folded, the chin high. He had the exact posture of a successful general, mid-campaign. He also had horns. 3 black ones, to be exact, poking from his forehead at irregular angles. One was long, the other 2 mere stubs, and that wasn't all. Some kind of dorsal spine had split the back of his shirt. A grey-green flange protruded from his left arm. The face was waxy and irregular, swollen with internal pressure. The eyes seemed living flames. "That's unexpected," I thought.
"His essence is breaking out of the body."
It was Nathaniel's boundless capacity for stating the obvious that made him so charmingly human. As we watched, the horns, spine, and flanges shrank back into the skin as if by a stern effort of will. A quivering, a shaking, a moment later they sprang back, bigger than ever. From the open mouth the great voice came roaring,
"Ah, the discomfort! I feel the old burning! Fakwal! Where is Fakwal?"
"He's not happy," Nathaniel thought. "His power must simply be too great. The fabric of his host is breaking apart, and he's lost its protection. Can't help that he's been wolfing down humans since he got here. That must have swelled his essence." I surveyed the commoners cowering below him. "Looks as if he's still hungry, too."
"This ends now."
All Nathaniel's unhappiness and dissatisfaction had coalesced into cold, hard fury. His mind was a piece of flint.
"Think we can pick him off from here?"
"Yes. Aim carefully. We'll have 1 chance only. Better make it a strong one."
"Now who's stating the obvious?"
We were still crouched, peering through the ornate iron railings that bounded the gantry. As Nathaniel composed himself to stand, I erected a precautionary shield. When the strike was done, the other spirits would no doubt seek revenge. I scanned the possibilities. First an evasive leap, either to the palm tree, or backward onto the sushi bar roof, then down to the floor. Then—well, that was enough forward planning. Nathaniel stood. We pointed the staff at Nauda, spoke the words. A tremendous explosion, as expected. Only not around Nauda, but all around us. My shield just about held firm. Even so, we were blown sideways down the gantry and through the glass wall of the palace in a shower of crystal fragments to go spinning out over the entrance steps and down to the darkness of the ornamental gardens far below. We landed heavily, our fall only partially buffered by the shield. The staff, torn from our grip, clattered distantly on the path. Our dual consciousness was shaken apart by the impact. For a few seconds we vibrated separately in a single head. As we lay there, groaning independently, the body of Hopkins came drifting out through the shattered aperture high above. It floated down to the steps and approached on foot, at a calm and steady pace.
"It's Mandrake, isn't it?" Fakwal said,
in conversational tones.
"I must say, you're a persistent little fellow. If you'd had any sense, you'd have been 100 miles away by now. What on earth's got into you?"
"If he only knew." We lay on the soil, trying hard to focus. Slowly our vision steadied, our intelligence realigned.
"The Lord Nauder," Fakwal continued, "is a little fractious at the moment, and needs careful handling. His temper would not be improved by being stung by your toy."
"Stung?" Nathaniel croaked. "It'll wipe him out."
"Do you really think so?"
The voice was tired and amused.
"Nauder is greater than you can guess. He is ravenous for energy. He absorbs it like a sponge. See how he grows already. He would welcome your attack and feed off it. I would have let you try it, but I am tired of unnecessary disruptions. However, in a moment I shall take the staff for my own use."
He raised a languid hand.
"So then, farewell."
Nathaniel opened his mouth to scream. I hijacked it for a better purpose.
"Hello, Fakwal."
The hand started. Its baleful energies remained unreleased. Behind Hopkins's eyes, twin points of bright blue light flared in wonder and confusion.
"Bartimaeus?"
"Little me."
How?
Here was a thing. For the first time in 3 dozen centuries, Fakwal's impregnable assurance was shaken by my arrival. He was at a loss for words.
"How can this be? Is this a trick? Some voice projection? An illusion?"
"Nope. It's me in here."
"It can't be."
"Who else would know the truth about the death of Genghis? Those little poisoned grapes we slipped into his tent under the noses of his djinn." I won't go into this. It was just a little Asian job, a long while back. Fakwal blinked. He hesitated.
"So, it is you."
"My turn to deal out the surprise, old friend. And I might just mention that while you and Nauder play around in there, most of your army has already been killed. By me." As I spoke, I felt Nathaniel squirming. He didn't like lying helpless on the ground. A natural instinct of self-preservation made him desperate to get up. I quelled him with a single thought.
"Wait. Ah, you traitor!"
Fakwal had been in Hopkins's body for a long time. He licked his lips just as a human might.
"I care nothing for that loss. The world is crammed with humans, and there are spirits enough to fill them all. But as for you, to murder your own kind, to defend your old oppressors, no, it sickens my essence to think of it."
His hands were clenched. His voice was high with emotion.
"We have fought each other many times, Bartimaeus, but always because of chance, because of our master's whims. And now, when we are the masters at last and should celebrate together, now you choose to carry out this rank betrayal. You, Sakr al-Jinni himself, how can you justify your actions?"
"Me, the traitor?" To begin with, I had just been keeping him talking, waiting till our strength recovered from our fall. But now I was too incensed to think. My voice rose to the old Wendigo roar that echoed through the pine woods and kept the tribes cowering in their teepees.
"You're the one who's turned his back forever on the other place. How much more of a traitor can you be? To desert your home, to encourage fellow spirits to abandon it forever by becoming squatters in these bags of bones? And for what? What do you get from this benighted wasteland?"
"Vengeance," Fakwal whispered.
"Vengeance is our master here. It keeps us in this world. It gives us purpose."
"Purpose is a human concept," I said quietly. "We never needed that before. This body of yours isn't just a disguise anymore, is it? It isn't just a barrier against pain.
It's what you're busily becoming.
The fire behind the eyes flared indignantly, then dwindled suddenly, grew dull.
Perhaps so, Bartimaeus, perhaps so.
The voice was soft and wistful. The hands patted the front of the rumpled suit.
Between ourselves, I will admit to feeling a certain discomfort in this body that I had not anticipated. It is not like the old sharp pain we have long withstood. Rather, it's a dull itch that nags at me, a hollowness inside that no amount of slaughter can quite ease. So far, at any rate.
He gave a rueful grin.
I intend to keep trying.
That hollowness, I said, it's what you've lost. The tie to the other place. Fakwal gazed at me. For a moment he did not speak.
If that is true, he said heavily, then you have lost it too. You are just as much a squatter as I, Bartimaeus, cooped up in that young magician of yours. Why did you do it, if you despise the notion as you claim?
Because I have a way out, I said. I haven't burned my bridges. The blazing eyes narrowed in puzzlement.
How so?
The magician summoned me in. The magician can dismiss me.
But his brain
is whole. I share it with him. Which is tough, admittedly. There's not much to go round. Nathaniel spoke then.
It is true. We work together.
If Fakwal had been surprised when I first spoke, he was now dumbfounded. The possibility simply hadn't occurred to him.
The human retains his intelligence, he muttered. Who then is the master? Which of you has dominance?
Neither of us, I said. Nathaniel concurred.
It is an equal balance.
Fakwal shook his head, almost as if in admiration.
Remarkable, he said. As a perversity, it is unique. Or almost so. That brat from Alexandria you were always going on about at one time, Bartimaeus, he'd have approved, wouldn't he?
His lip curled a little. Tell me, do you not feel soiled by such an intimate association?
Not particularly, I said.
It's no more intimate than yours, and it's a lot less permanent. I'm going home.
Oh, dear. What makes you think that?
Fakwal moved his hand, but I'd anticipated him. Our long discussion had given us a chance to recover from the fall. Our energies were rekindled. Nathaniel's fingers were already pointed in his direction. The green-grey spasm hit Fakwal's shield directly. Though uninjured, he spun round. His detonation struck the earth well clear. Meanwhile, I exercised our limbs. With a scattering of soil, we launched from the ground, soared above the path, landed right beside the staff. Nathaniel scooped it up. We turned, quick as a striking crate. Fakwal stood on the path, not distant, hand half raised. Light from the glass palace cut across him, blending with the shadow. Fast as we'd been, he was still faster. I sometimes wonder if he could have got us in the back, as we bent beside the staff, before we'd got it in our hand. But maybe our spasm had shaken him, put him off his stride. It's difficult to say. For a second we gazed at each other.
"Your discovery is remarkable," Fakwal said. "But it comes too late for me."
He made some movement or other with his fleshy body. I don't remember what. I did nothing, but I was conscious of the boy's immediate command. A stab of pure white light. It faded, vanished, scoured Fakwal from the earth. We stood alone on the path beneath the palace.
"Shake a leg," the boy thought. "People are coming, and we've got a final bit of work to do."
Chapter 36 Kitty. It was fortunate for Kitty that most of the magicians in her company were from the very lowest ranks, since this meant that several of them could drive. Limousines were located in the lot beneath Westminster Hall. The chauffeur's mess provided a choice of keys. By the time six vehicles arrived, revving in the deserted street outside, Kitty and the others had retrieved what weapons they could, negotiated the summoning of a number of imps, and were waiting at the door. Without ceremony, they bundled in, four to a car, and with the demons hovering in their wake, proceeded in procession up the road. They did not get far. Halfway up Whitehall, they found the way blocked by rubble from a toppled war memorial. Progress was impeded. Laboriously, the convoy turned, retreated to Parliament Square, and turned right towards St. James's Park. If Whitehall had been empty, the streets to the south of the park were anything but. Not far ahead came explosions, reflected lights, and the sound of howling wolves. Closer still, as if a human dam had burst, hundreds of people surged from the side roads, swamping the thoroughfare and pouring down toward the limousines. Kitty was sitting in the lead car, beside the driver. Sudden fear lurched in her. "Get out," she snapped. "It isn't safe." He saw the danger, switched off the engine, fumbled with the door. As one, they left the cars and ran for shelter. Seconds later, the crowd engulfed the limousines, eyes wild, faces set in expressions of terror and despair. Many ran straight past, others, seeing in the sleek black vehicles stark symbols of the magician's rule, lashed out at them, kicking, screaming. A brick appeared from nowhere, a windscreen smashed. The crowd's voice roared. Miss Piper supported Kitty, who was shaking with the effort of their escape.
"The commoners," she whispered. "They've gone insane." "They're scared. They're angry."
Kitty struggled to gather her strength.
"Look at their injuries. They've escaped from the park.
Now, are we all present?" As she looked down the straggling line of magicians, a thought struck her.
"Those of you with imps, get them under your jackets," she hissed.
"If anyone with resilience spots them, you'll be torn apart.
Ready? Right. Come on, we've no time to waste."
Without delay, they continued up the street on foot, keeping to the margins as the flow of human traffic swept by. The first few side roads were choked with rushing bodies and proved impassable. Little by little they drew near to the sounds of fighting. A flash of light in the darkness. Silhouetted on a building, the outline of a man. Green fires billowed all about him. The light went out. In the street below, a small number of wolves were massing. They heard a high voice shouting orders, glimpsed a dark-haired form.
"That's Farah," one of the magicians said. "She's got some wolves together. But what was that shape?" "One of the demons."
Kitty was leaning wearily against a wall and looking down a narrow alley.
"This way's clear. It'll get us to the park."
"But shouldn't we?"
"No, that's just a sideshow.
Besides, I don't think dear Miss Farah would really want our help, do you?"
The alley led by circuitous twists and turns to a quiet road running along the edge of the park. This they crossed, and from a small eminence looked down upon the black expanse. A few fires burned here and there, in trees, in pavilions, in the pagoda down by the lake, but little movement could be seen. At Kitty's suggestion, a number of imps were sent ahead to spy out the land. They returned in moments.
"Terrible battle has been waged here," said the first, wringing its webbed hands. "At intervals the ground is crisp and charred. Magical effusions hang over the ground like fog, but the battle has ceased everywhere, save in one place."
"Many humans have perished," said the second,
goggle-eyes blinking on their stalks.
"Their bodies lie like fallen leaves. Some lie wounded, they cry for help. A few others wander without purpose. But most have fled. The park is empty of crowds, save in one place."
"The great spirits are likewise gone," said the third,
flapping its gauzy wings.
"Their spilled essence hangs amid the echoes of their screams. A few survivors have fled across the city, but none remain in the park, save in one place."
"And what," Kitty asked, tapping her foot gently, "is that place?"
Wordlessly, the three imps turned and pointed up at the lights of the great glass palace. Kitty nodded.
"Why didn't you say so?"
"All right. Let's go."
For 10 hard and silent minutes, they walked across the blackened ground. Kitty went slowly, forcibly completing each step against the shrill protests of her body. In the hours since her return, her strength had dripped back steadily. Even so, she longed to rest. She knew she was reaching the end of her endurance. The imp's reports had been pithy, but the implication of them was clear, and fitted in with the glimpse in the crystal. Nathaniel and Bartimaeus had been here. It was they who had cleared the park and enabled many of the people to escape. Perhaps, the hope swelled inside her with each step, perhaps they would soon complete the process. Perhaps she would see them coming toward her in triumph, with a group of grateful commoners in their train. Surely with the staff it was only a matter of time. But while there was any doubt, she could not hold back. She could not leave them. At her neck, the amulet of Samarkand bounced gently with each faltering step. 5 minutes passed. Kitty's eyes grew heavy. Suddenly they blinked alert.
"What was that?" "Magical blast," Miss Piper whispered, "by the eastern entrance."
They kept walking. 4 minutes later, with the palace looming over them, they entered the ornamental gardens. As they did so, the ground shook. A piercing white light flashed upon the path before the building. The company stopped dead, waited. The light was not repeated. Nervousness crackled between them, like an electric charge. Kitty's eyes strained in the dark. The glow from the palace cast the night into even greater shadow. It was hard to be sure. But yes, there upon the path, a figure standing. As she watched, it moved, and was silhouetted against the glass. Kitty hesitated just a moment. Then she stumbled forward, calling. Nathaniel. At the sound of the voice, Nathaniel stopped dead. It barely even carried to his brain, what with his ears buzzing from 100 detonations, and with the vibrations of the thirsty staff humming near at hand. But the little call did what all the demons across the park had failed to do. It set his heart racing. Throughout the battle he had moved with demonic speed and efficiency, avoiding death without much effort and exerting, through the staff, destructive energies greater than many djinn possessed. It was an experience that had been desired by most magicians through the centuries, and certainly by Nathaniel himself in idle daydreams. It was the feeling of consummate superiority, the delight of power wielded without peril. He danced beneath the dark night sky, smiting down his enemies, and yet with all his nimbleness and guile, with all the adrenaline pumping through him, deep inside he was curiously inert. He felt aloof, disconnected, and alone. If his hatred for the demons that he had killed was dull and almost matter-of-fact, so was his sympathy for the people whose lives he saved. The woman in Trafalgar Square had shown what he could expect from them. They would regard him with fear and distaste, and rightly so. He was a magician. It was thanks to him and his kind that London was in flames. Pride spurred him on. That and the djinni talking inside his head. Yes, he would seek to end the destruction. But after that, actions were one thing, expectations another. He had no idea what he would do. And then, on the path outside the great glass palace, the djinni's thought drifted through his mind. "That's Kitty's voice, that is."
"I know. You think I don't know?"
"It's just you've gone all limp and heavy, like wet cardboard. Thought you'd had a seizure out of fear."
"It's not fear."
"So you say. Your heart's going like the clappers. Yuck, and you've gone a bit sweaty. Sure, it isn't a fever."
"Quite sure. Now will you shut up?"
Nathaniel watched her coming slowly through the garden. Across the seven plains her aura lit the ground like day. A group of people straggled close behind.
"Kitty!" "Nathaniel!"
They looked at each other. Then his mouth opened with a wrenching noise, something like a belch.
"And me! Don't forget me!"
Nathaniel swore and clamped his mouth tight shut. Kitty grinned.
"Hello, Bartimaeus."
An entirely unconnected anger suddenly rose within Nathaniel. He frowned at her.
"I thought I told you not to come with us. You're too weak. It's too dangerous."
"Since when have I ever listened to you? What's the situation?"
Nathaniel's mouth opened of its own accord. Bartimaeus spoke. "We've destroyed most of Nauda's army, but he himself is still at large. In there." Nathaniel's thumb jerked back over his shoulder. "With 7 other spirits and maybe 100 commoners. And we're..."
"About to deal with him," Nathaniel finished.
"In serious trouble," the djinni said.
Kitty blinked. Sorry, which?
Nathaniel shifted the staff. Thin bands of energy pulsed and crackled around his hand. He felt a surge of joyful impatience. He would destroy Nauda, rescue the commoners, and return to Kitty. Beyond that, everything could wait. But the Jinni was cutting across his thoughts, speaking urgently to Kitty. Nauda is growing in strength all the time. He's not reacting like the others. He may not be as susceptible to the staff as we thought. Nathaniel interrupted angrily. What do you mean? It'll be fine. That's not what Fakwal said.
Oh, and you believed him?
Fakwal didn't tend to lie. That wasn't his style.
No, his style was trying to kill us dead.
Nathaniel broke off. He had caught sight of a ring of silent listeners, watching him seemingly argue with himself. Among several magicians that he recognized was his personal assistant. He cleared his throat.
Hello, Piper.
Hello, sir.
Kitty held up a hand. Bartimaeus, there are many prisoners in there, and we have little time. Do we have any alternative to the staff?
No, unless this crowd is all magicians of the 13th level.
Right. Then we've got to go for it, better or worse, Nathaniel, Kitty said. You'll have to do what you can. If you deal with the demons, we'll evacuate the commoners. Where are they?
Close by, in the center of the palace.
In the past, her presence disconcerted him. Now it filled him with renewed purpose and self-belief. He spoke swiftly, with his old authority.
Piper, when you get inside, you will see a path running to the right between the palms. It leads behind the carousel to an open area. That's where the demons and the captives are. If you wait down that path, in cover, I'll attack from the opposite side. When the demons follow me, try to lead the prisoners out and as far away as possible. Anyone with imps, use them to help you. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Good. Kitty, you should wait outside.
I should, but I won't. I've got the amulet, remember?
Nathaniel knew better than to argue. He turned toward the entrance to the palace.
Absolute silence when we're in. I'll give you a minute to get into positions.
He held open the door. One by one, with wide eyes and pale, strained faces, the company of magicians trooped past and disappeared up the path. Several were accompanied by their imps, who wore identical expressions of unease. Last to go through was Kitty. She paused for a moment on the step.
"Well done," she whispered, gesturing back toward the empty park. "You and Bartimaeus. I should have said."
Nathaniel grinned at her. Impatience tugged within him. The staff sang.
"It's almost over," he said softly. "Go on. After you."
The door shut quietly behind them. Bartimaeus. There are times when even a near omnipotent jinni knows to keep his mouth shut, and this was one of them. I wouldn't have got anywhere. Trouble was, neither of them was in a mood to listen to my doubts. For one thing, they smelled success too strongly. Him with the staff held casually in his hand, her with the amulet warm against her breast. Such trinkets breed confidence. And besides, they'd done too much already to imagine any stumbles now. But the main problem was the way they played off each other. Simply put, their mutual presence spurred each other on. Trapped as I was inside Nathaniel, I could certainly see how the girl inspired him. Too right I could. It was as if she'd triggered an internal one-man band, all klaxons, bells, and penny whistles, with enthusiastic cymbals strapped between his knees. The noise was deafening. Perhaps I can't vouch for Kitty so much, but in my vast experience, strong characters of their sort tend to gravitate together. Pride has a part to play in it, and other emotions too. Neither wishes to fail. Each redoubles their efforts to impress. Things get done, but not always the right things, or not always the things expected. That's how it was with Nefertiti and Akhenaten, of course. One moment it was lingering looks and assignations by the crocodile enclosure, next it was tearing up the state religion and moving Egypt's capital 60 miles into the desert. One thing just led to another, and there's not much you can do to stop it. It has to be said, however, that in the present instance, there really wasn't any viable alternative to Nathaniel's plan. Nauda was far too powerful for the rather lackluster remnants of the government to destroy. So the staff was the only option. But Fakwal's phrase rang uneasily in my mind. He would welcome your attack and feed off it. And call me pessimistic, but that struck me as a mite ominous. Fakwal wasn't a sly old equivocator like Chu. He prided himself on blunt speaking. Mind you, he did have a weakness for boasting. If you believed all his stories, you'd have thought him responsible for most of the world's major landmarks, as well as being advisor and confidant to all the notable magicians. This, as I once remarked to Solomon, was a quite ridiculous claim. But it was too late to worry about that now. The staff had flattened cities. With luck, it would stand us in good stead. Kitty and her ragtag company went one way through the palms. Nathaniel and I went the other. We ignored the stairs this time, kept to ground level. Away to our right we heard roars and screams, so that was all right. Nauda hadn't gone anywhere. "What's the plan?" my thought flitted through Nathaniel's mind.
"We need to draw Nauda off, get him away from the commoners before we attack. How can we do that?"
"I recommend goading. Goading usually works."
"I'll leave that up to you."
"The other spirits need to be dealt with, too," I thought. "Before or after?"
"Before, or they'll kill the commoners."
"You control the staff. I'll keep us moving. I warn you, we're going to have to be pretty mobile for this." He made a dismissive gesture.
"I can cope with a few leaps and bounds."
"Ready, then?"
"The others will be in position. Yes, let's go."
"Ooh!" I hadn't tried flying up to now, since it took a lot of energy. But this was the big one. This was where everything counted, and Fakwal had seemed to manage it well enough. So without further ado, I lifted us off the path, up beside the palms. For a nasty moment, I thought the boy was going to drop the staff. For an even nastier moment, I thought he was going to be sick. But he held on to one, and held in the other. "What's the matter with you?"
Never flown before."
"This is nothing. You should try looping the loop on a carpet. That would really make you green." It was an odd historical fact that the British magicians had no interest in magical flying, being inclined, wisely it must be said, to trust to mechanical means instead. But other cultures had no qualms about fusing djinn with inanimate objects. The Persians went in for carpets. Certain down-at-heel Europeans went by mortar and pestle. Venturesome Chinese magicians even tried their hand at riding clouds. "Okay, enemies coming in sight. Staff at the ready." We soared up over the palm trees. Electric lights shone down upon us. All around stretched the great glass dome. Beyond it was the greater dome of night, and there ahead the open space with huddled prisoners and spirit guards much as before. Perhaps there were slightly fewer prisoners this time. It was hard to tell. But surprisingly little had changed. The reason for this stood writhing on the roof of the carousel. Poor Nauda was having a terrible time with his host. Makepeace's body just wasn't up to scratch. From almost every surface, protuberances of one sort or another were zealously poking, carving the clothes to ribbons. There were horns, spines, wedges, flanges, wings, tentacles, and polyps of a dozen hues. Other bulges remained beneath the skin, deforming it into rippling crests and valleys, so that the human contours were almost entirely blurred. The old legs had been joined by three others, of varying stages of development. One arm seemed to have gained a second elbow joint. It swung to and fro in complex agitation. The face was contorted like a pufferfish's. Small barbs extended from the cheeks. Nota bene, I'm still talking about face here. The eyes had disappeared in gouts of flame. The mouth, which now swept round from ear to ear, let out a piteous roaring.
"The pain of it! All around me is the pinch of iron! Bring Fakwal here! Bring him here before me! His advice has been most unsatisfactory. I wish to reprimand him."
The spirit in the body of Rupert Devereux spoke cringingly from below.
We do not know where Fakwal is, Lord Nauda. He appears to have departed.
But I gave the strictest instructions. He is, to attend me while I feed. Oh, there is such an ache inside my belly, a void that must be quenched. Bolib, Gaspar, bring me another brace of humans, that I might distract myself.
It was at this moment that Nathaniel and I, flying down from on high, with the air buffeting against us and our coat billowing in our wake, shot three spirits with a triple blast. We did it so fast, so precisely, that the humans, trembling nearby, scarcely noticed they had gone. The other spirits looked up. The ceiling lights dazzled them. Their retorts went wide, arcing out harmlessly beneath the glass. We swooped low. The star flared, once, twice, another two hybrids vanished. A turn, so sharp that Nathaniel was for an instant horizontal in the air, a sudden gut-churning drop as a disembowelment flittered overhead. Another shot, this one missed the target. Gaspar, the spirit with the unenviable fate of occupying Rufus Lime, had himself taken to the air. He climbed toward us, firing detonations. We banked, flew behind a knot of trees. As we emerged above them, their canopy burst into livid flames. Below us, the humans were suddenly possessed by panic. They split in myriad directions. Out of the corner of our eye, we saw Kitty and the magicians breaking from the trees. Up on the roof of the carousel, Nauda was swaying from side to side in some annoyance.
"What is this intrusion? Who besets us?"
We flew past at a cheeky distance.
"Bartimaeus here," I called. "Remember me?"
A sudden twist high toward the dome. Rupert Devereux's body had risen to meet us. Blue fire gusted from his hands. Nathaniel's thought protruded.
"That was your goading? Remember me? I could do better than that. I can't goad properly when I'm concentrating on something else."
We had risen almost to the ceiling glass. We saw stars glinting peacefully far away. Then I dropped us vertically like a stone. Devereux's spasm shattered the pane above. It arced out into the night. Nathaniel fired our staff. It caught Devereux a glancing blow upon the legs, setting them aflame. Tumbling and flailing, he spiraled down in a trail of smoke, plunged into the mystic tent of prophecy, and exploded in a burst of iridescent light.
"Where's Lime?" Nathaniel thought. "Can't see him."
"Don't know. Look at Nauda. He's our problem now." Whether or not spurred to action by my coruscating wit, or simply through displeasure at seeing the remnants of his army slain, Nauda had suddenly exerted himself. Great green wings erupted from his back. Slowly at first, labouring under the disadvantages of his grotesque asymmetry, he stumbled to the lip of the carousel roof, hesitated like a fledgling on its maiden flight, then stepped off. The mighty wings beat once. Too late. He'd already landed spread-eagled on the ground.
"Get him," I said. "Get him now."
We dropped down as fast as I could manage it, Nathaniel's jaw clamped tight shut with the speed of the descent. As we plummeted, Nathaniel lessened the constraints upon the entities of the staff, opened it up as much as he dared. Their energies erupted, lanced down upon the wriggling body in a flower of light.
"Keep it going," I said. "Keep it going. Don't leave anything to chance." "I know. I'm doing it."
Our descent slowed, slowed. We hovered in midair. Below, a milky white inferno raged. Nauda and the carousel were deep within it. Heat plumed outward, cracked the glass on nearby panes, burned the air around us. I erected a small shield to deflect the full ferocity. The vibrations of the staff grew greater, ran up our arm and shook within our skull.
"What do you think?" the boy thought. "Enough?" "Must be.
No, play safe. A little longer."
"I can't hold it for much. Ah!"
I'd seen the shadow rising, sensed the movement in the air. I'd flung us aside, but the detonation caught us, broke my shield apart, struck us on the side, even as we spun away. The boy cried out, and I cried with him. For the first and only time I shared a human's pain. Something in the feeling. Perhaps it was the dull immobility of the flesh, the way it just sat there, accepting the wound, made panic ripple through my essence. The boy's mind teetered on the edge of consciousness. His fingers loosened on the staff. Its energies died back. I gripped it harder, spun it round, sent white fire lashing beneath the dome to cut straight through the